day. In fact, how much pressure is it to get it on the web as soon as possible?
Oh, intense pressure for all of us, no matter what platform a journalist works in. The deadline, you're right. When I'm old enough to where, when I started in this business, in my grandpa voice, when I started in this business, you know, you had a deadline. It was probably around 5 or 6 o'clock, and you could take your time and get everything right, double-check everything, write it up, have it edited, rewrite it, submit it again, and then you go home. And then the story still doesn't get out until, you know, 6 o'clock the next morning. Those days are long gone. Deadlines all the time. And so here's a point that I want to make about this. Patricia's exactly right. And she was one of those people, by the way, that was getting the word out on social media. It exploded around the world, literally. That's not a metaphor. That's actual truth. Antonio French, Patricia, others were there and were tweeting, taking photographs and sending them out. That's a huge element. So it's much different than it was. However, if you just got your news, and I use the term loosely, about Ferguson from social media, you would have quickly seen things that were just not right. In fact, not only were they not right, they were dead wrong. There was a rumor that was spread like wildfire, again, around the world, literally, that the police officer in question had suffered a fractured eye socket. You probably saw that, right?
That was a picture, yeah.
And someone mocked up a fake picture and put it on Twitter. Well, it's on Twitter. Well, my gosh, I better share it. Okay. We never ran a word of that until we could track it down, and we found out it was false. And then we were very happy that we hadn't have done that. And what's the difference there? The difference there is that, you know, journalists, and I know there's some NABJ members here, and God bless you, young journalists, young, smart, aspiring journalists, you have to save us here, our society here, from this trend of just spreading rumor and spreading opinion about things and not getting to the fact. Because traditional journalism, as wizened and wrinkled as it seems to be, traditional journalism still holds that the most important thing is the truth. The truth. And so you don't report things that you just see on Twitter. You go and check it out, and you figure it out. And you do it fast, because you're still competing against all those folks. So it's very fascinating how this is developed, and it will continue to do so.
Okay. Got a question. Do you believe that the citizen response to the media presence was exceptional? And if so, what might that say about the desperation of the citizens to, quote, have eyes on a dire situation? Who wants to take that one?
A citizen journalist, are they journalists? I don't think that a citizen journalist is going to look at a story or a something happening the same way that I would, because I'm in search of the truth. I'm impartial. I'm taking my feelings and my emotions out of this, and I'm just trying to find out what happened and how to get those answers. And I don't think that I think citizen journalists, they can insert their own emotions in it, and so that just makes my job and their job very, very different to me.
And that's one of the, that was the next question. What makes somebody a journalist? Because we hear the term citizen journalist all the time. Those of us who went to school for journalism, and there's, you know, I know that some of the purists will say, if you didn't go to school for it, then you're not a journalist. I don't believe in that.
Yeah.
Bradley?
Well, I believe what makes you a journalist, the fact that you want to tell the real story, from a perspective, either your perspective or from a perspective of others, makes you kind of a journalist. That's a good question. That's a very good question. What makes you a journalist? But I believe the fact that you want to tell a story from a perspective other than your own gets you to be one.
Bill, I'm going to pull this to you.
I think I agree. And we don't want to be so exclusive about who gets to qualify for the, you know, the club of being journalists, that we turn up our nose at citizen journalists who, I mean, maybe they are recording events from a particular point of view, but still, I mean, if you were if you were trying to figure out what was going on the streets of Ferguson the nights of all the protests and the riots and the looting, the tweets of Antonio French and of Patricia were really crucial to figuring that out. I mean, we had at St. Louis Public Radio, we had Kelsey Proud, and she's backed up by Erica Smith, who were putting together all of the most responsible tweets they found from Patricia, from Antonio French, from Post-Dispatch photographers and reporters who were on the scene, from St. Louis Public Radio reporters on the scene, and really to get the whole picture, it required the eyewitness accounts of all of those folks. So, you know, I asked Patricia before we came out here, are you a citizen journalist? And are you a politician? And she sort of said both. And I sort of go with her on that.
Mm-hmm. I would add, I think before the days of Twitter and Facebook, people who we would be considered citizen journalists would be who the reporters who would be coming to, the journalists would be coming to for the story. And I think citizen journalism kind of evolved from the need of another voice, a different perspective. I think maybe what's not told sometimes is reporters, in order to do their job, they have to develop some level of relationship with the persons or the entities in that they're reporting on. And through having to develop that relationship, sometimes everything isn't told. So there are other people with, hey, I don't have anything to lose. I'm going to put it out there. And what are you going to do? And it's a different kind of reporting, because sometimes everything can't be told at the time that it happens with journalists because of those relationships. So it's a kind of a balance that needs to be striked, but sometimes to hear a different perspective or see a different perspective, I think that's important in giving people a full picture of the story. It's a voice that they wouldn't have before.
Another question. After the night of unrest, I would open the Post-Dispatch the next day and read the accounts. Often the chronology in the story was based on the statement, quote, police said. Many times, the series of events were just not factual. For instance, statements about when police moved in and when they fired tear gas was used. Having been there, the repetition of these falsehoods was disconcerting. Didn't the police department have somebody on the scenes those late nights? And why were the police statements taken at face value?
Well, since that was the Post-Dispatch, I can try to address that. It's a good question. Why do we just put what the police say in the paper? And I've heard that question over the years many times, and it's an excellent question. I would answer it this way. The police, you need to ask the police what they did and what they encountered, but you don't need to take it at face value. You don't just believe it. That's like asking a politician, no offense, Patricia, asking a politician and then getting the answer and just being a stenographer and putting it down and then walking away. You can't do that. However, when there's an event that happened and it involved the police and the reporter was not there, the reporter must check with police or the reporter's not doing his or her job because the police were there. That doesn't mean the police are going to tell the truth. And we know that over the years police lie in certain crucial situations. We also know that police sometimes don't lie, but they don't exactly get the truth. And this goes back to what Patricia was talking about, and I totally agree. You know, you have to go beyond just the official statement. If you're a journalist, you go and you find the person that actually was standing out there. You look on Twitter and you see the photos that people are actually taking and putting up. You know, that's a piece of evidence. That's a testimony. That is an eyewitness account. And then I think the ethical journalist weighs all of these factors as best they can in the time allotted. And that's a key phrase, in the time allotted. You know, we may not have had time to check out every detail of the police account of what happened over an 8-hour period or 10-hour period or 12-hour period. You know, we do the best we can. There's a saying, an old saying, again, I'm dating myself here. There's an old saying that journalism is the first rough draft of history. And that's exactly right, because it is not what's in the paper tomorrow or what's on our website right now or what's on STL Public Radio or what's on the St. Louis American or any other number of websites and news organizations is not necessarily the total story. In fact, it probably isn't the total story, but it's the best that we can do for now.
Another question. There are a variety of examples of how the media portrays white suspects and killers better than black victims. Moving forward, if any, what steps or solution is the media taking to stop these types of portrayals? How are we combating stereotypes in the media?
Well, that's a question that I think all of us battle. For myself, trying to come into the industry, being a student, I think you notice that. I do believe it's an oversight most of the time. I think they often don't realize the words that are used to describe certain people in certain situations. But I do believe that it's up to the people that are watching and viewing those particular avenues of media via online broadcast or even on social media. It's important for those views to be spoken up because oftentimes media only cover stories or produce material that they feel people want to see. And so if I'm an editor of a paper or if I'm a news director of a TV station, I want to try to feel the vibe of my community. And if the vibe of my community says, you know what, they're saying black people are, they're giving adjectives or words to describe black people that are way worse than white suspect. Well, but maybe we should start thinking of redoing that kind of approach. That's going to happen because people are speaking up, and those people that are speaking up are the ones that are viewing the material. So,
yeah, I think that viewers should remember that you too have a voice. And during the Ferguson coverage, we were literally like nonstop, 24 hours a day, Ferguson, 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 until many of our viewers pointed it out, like, what else is going on in St. Louis? I know there's other news. And we said, okay, well, let's look at our newscast and let's see how we can, you know, make this a little bit more neutral. And so that was because viewers called in or they emailed in and they shared their opinion with us. And we don't know if unless you say something.
So this is a question along the same lines. Why, given that other black men have been unjustly murdered, Trayvon Martin, Oscar Grant, has the death of Michael Brown been the flashpoint for national concern and media coverage at this level? I think, given that I'm also local, I'm also national, I can tell you that when you have the pictures and you have the community out there taking the photos, putting them on social media, and it becomes a story, I mean, the first word that we got is a young guy was trying to give himself up with his hands up saying don't shoot and was shot and killed, you know, shot like six times. I think that becomes the kind of a story that you say, well, wait a minute. You know, it wasn't like, you know, everybody, he was unarmed. He wasn't even running away. That's one of the things that makes it a national story, in my view.
Yeah, I was going to say, I think it's partly the fact that it was the latest in a series of all these other events. It was also the 4.5 hours that he was allowed to lie out on that street, which wasn't required by any kind of police procedures. So I think that I think those were two factors that made it blossom into this big story.
I think what made this a big national and international story was the fact that it was an unarmed black teen shot by a white cop. That's one perspective. Another perspective, that he was allowed to lay on the ground for 4.5 hours. You have the response of the community around him seeing his body on the ground for 4.5 hours. You have the response on social media, and then you have the police response to the people's response of seeing his body on the ground for 4.5 hours. So all those things made this an international story in that order.
Mariah, what do you think? I mean, you and Brandon are young journalists just getting into the business. So, you know, what is your thought on this?
Well, St. Louis has has always been a hostile environment between police and citizens. Everyone has a story. You go to these town hall meetings, everyone has a story to tell, or they know somebody that's been directly affected by the police relationship here. So everyone was emotionally attached when it finally happened here. And it has happened here before. It was just, I guess, people were bottled up and this broke it loose. Like Bradley said, the reaction that this community had, that's what put this story over the top. Because it has been said before by some of the protesters I talked to, they said, you know, if Trayvon Martin was to happen here, we know something was going to happen, and that's what happened.
Mm-hmm. Another question, why has the media not identified this excessive police brutality as a product of our society, which has been progressively declining internally due to failing systems? We know there's trouble with police all across the country. You know, we've seen it. I'm not sure if it's because of declining systems, but failing systems.
May I speak on something? And especially with this being a National Association of Black Journalists, I think that when we have the questions that are asked about how black people are portrayed in the media, we have to talk about the diversity or the lack of diversity in media in covering these stories. And I do believe that people know the power of the words that they use. I am not going to let anyone in journalism get away with they don't understand how blacks are portrayed in this country in the media. I'm just not. We know the power of words. I remember even maybe about a year or so ago, I think there was a station, or maybe it was a Post-Dispatch, said that they were going to stop using the terms on the north side or the south side when a murder or something happened because people said, hey, this isn't fair. We want to get away from just assuming, oh, a south side, north side murder. I don't know. Was that the Post in that said stop doing that? But there is a new... I don't know if it's the news or the Post-Dispatch said, when we report about a murder, we're not going to say on the north side or south side. We're going to give the street address now, and people can figure it out on their own. So I think that if there was a louder voice in the media, in the mainstream media, because I think in black media, there have been several stories about excessive force and police brutality, but... without those voices at in the mainstream media, being in the editorial rooms, writing a lot of the op-eds, you're not necessarily going to hear about excessive force and police brutality. But in our neighborhoods, in our experiences, you will.
Brittany.
Yeah. So I was a reporter that would always, in the beginning, leave race out. So I'd say, police are looking for a man. Something along those lines. And so when I'm making friends with my police contacts and, you know, sitting down and talking to them and being real, one of the officers said, Brittany, if I tell you we're looking for this black guy and I'm giving you a description of the person I'm looking for, I want you to put that out. I don't want you to sugarcoat it. And this was an African-American officer that was talking to me. He said, I don't want you to sugarcoat it. This is what I'm looking for, and this is what I need you to put out. So if we're going to be on the same team, we need to work together. So I understand where you're coming from, but I just think that there is another side to that story.
I think it's also important to note that often people criticize things with just the idea just to criticize it, with no hope to do anything about it. I'm personally, if I want to talk about something, I want to make sure that I have a plan to change what I'm talking about. So a lot of times there are often not enough African Americans applying for police jobs. There are not enough African Americans applying for elected positions. There are not enough African Americans definitely applying for media jobs. And so if we want to, if the voice of the African American community wants to be heard, it has to be African Americans that are willing to stand up and be that voice.
So NABJ is very big on diversity in the media, not just on the air, especially behind the scenes, because your media coverage is not determined by the reporters out in the field. The news agenda is set by the news managers. And I can tell you that in St. Louis, the last time we did a report on media diversity in the TV newsrooms, it was almost none. In fact, I think of one person who was an executive producer who was at two and is now, I think, at four.
She's gone.
She's gone. So maybe there's nobody. But the reality is, you said more people have to apply for jobs. That's one of NABJ's major missions, is to be a clearinghouse for jobs and promotions for our members, for African-American, for black journalists. And I can tell you that if you look at the TV stations that we've looked at, just looking at TV, the last report we did, we looked at almost 300 TV stations, and 12% of the newsroom managers were people of color. It's African-American, Latino, Hispanic, and Native American. 12%. Now, as I've said very many times, I got no problem if you have no diversity in your newsroom in a place where there is no diversity in town. If you have a 92% white population, I'm not going to say anything about it if you have nobody of color on your management staff. I got a big problem if you have 40% diversity in your market and there's nobody of color on your management staff. So that's an issue that we have been addressing, you know, forever. One of my major jobs is to go out and talk to people, news managers, about hiring more of our members, especially in management positions, because that's where the real power is. I have a lot of questions coming in. Thank you very much. I think this is one story. Two stories have emerged after the shooting and its aftermath. One, the officer who we now know to be Darren Wilson had his skull crushed. This came from Fox. Now we've been told by reliable students that six young black men were killed in the 18 hours after Michael Brown was killed, and these stories were not reported. Where did these stories come from? Is the story concerning six killings an urban myth? Did Michael Brown actually suffer a crushed orbital eye socket? I heard that too, and I don't know the answer to that.
No, I think that's referring to the officer.
I'm sorry, Darren Wilson.
That
correct.
Was the right. false yet often repeated rumor that the officer had suffered a broken eye socket or orbital socket in some kind of confrontation with Michael Brown. That was flying around social media, and it was not true. And somebody even went to the extent of, and I don't know who, but somebody went to the extent of getting an X-ray of somebody else's eye socket, and putting it out there and saying that this was the officer's. So that was completely wrong. Six black men killed in the 18 hours. I haven't heard that. I don't believe that that's true. I know that we write about every homicide that occurs in the St. Louis area. Sometimes we don't write a lot about everyone, but we write about everyone. We keep a count. It's definitely part of the news report. I'm sure that KMOV and others do the same kind of thing. So I don't believe that's true.
Right after the shooting, like the day after, there was a lot of things floating around social media that somebody else, you know, had been shot and killed. And so I remember that day. Do you remember? We kept every time we got like a tweet, we would go to that location. We're like, okay, nothing. Sorry, false alarm, guys. And then we'd get another tweet, and we'd go there. So it might have just been rumors circulating again on social media.
And it did say six black men. It didn't say where. I mean, if it was around the nation, that could well have been true.
That's right.
This brings up another issue. The officer, somebody put his address and his house on the air. Right or wrong?
Wrong. KSDK did, and they apologized. They put the officer in, you know, potentially in danger. That's my opinion.
Had they shown the house and not put the address out, would that have been appropriate?
No, I don't think any kind of visual of Darren Wilson's house or car, any kind of things, because that's making I love to get justice for things, and what justice means to me is you do what's just, and so that's not doing what's just by showing his personal house or belongings before the process is done. So I believe that's wrong.
And I'm not putting down the fact that we know his name, but I've covered lots of officer involved shootings, and I don't know any of the officers that, you know, took part in the shooting or fired the shots, because that information is usually never released. I remember when we knew that the name was coming out, I remember it was discussion in our newsroom, like, are we even going to report this? And so, you know, going as far as to find his house and stuff, you know, even his name coming out was, you know, something for us to take in.
I think his name almost had to come out. Everybody knew who he was. I knew who he was. People were telling me who the police officer was when I got there. And I even had media wanted me to confirm, and I would not confirm the officer's name, but everybody in the community already knew the officer's name.
I think it's really important that the name come out. I mean, as much as I think it's wrong to take a picture of his house, I think it's absolutely important the name come out, and it should have come out sooner. Cincinnati, you know, that had a lot of problems about 12 years ago after there was a similar kind of shooting of a white officer shooting an African-American young man. And one of the things that they have changed is they immediately released the name of the officer who is involved in a shooting of a citizen. I think that's the way it should be.
Yeah, I know in Oakland and San Francisco, they will release the name. I know that I was reading something in one of the national media, or maybe it was on Facebook, I don't know. But it was about, I think it was the Post-Dispatch, trying to find out whether or not Michael Brown had a juvenile record, and they did a PRA for that. Is that correct?
Yeah, it absolutely is correct. One of the things that we did and continue to do is to find out everything we can find out about the incident, the tragedy, what happened, and also all the ramifications that we've been talking about. So in the course of that, we have launched an incredibly robust effort. I mean, almost everyone in our newsroom, and we're still, I think, the largest newsroom in the St. Louis region, and almost everyone in our newsroom in some way has been involved in reporting what happened to Michael Brown, what were the consequences, what happened afterwards, all the various trails of the story that we've been talking about. One of those pursuits actually was sparked by another one of those false rumors. You're talking about false rumors. One of the false rumors floating around and being spread around on social media was that Michael Brown, at the time of his death, faced some kind of a homicide charge. You know, I think it was second-degree murder. It was a very specific and very false, I might add, rumor. We never reported that. But in the course of figuring out Michael Brown was 18 years old when he was killed, when you're younger than 18, if you are charged with a crime, it's in the juvenile system. The juvenile system is not open. It's not typically open. That is, if the person's alive. Now, once a person is no longer alive, their records tend to be released. So we quite routinely, as part of our journalistic effort to figure out everything we could figure out, went and said, hey, we want to see any records that might exist on Michael Brown, knowing that there was this rumor going around. And we were told, no, you can't do that. And so, as we often do, and we do it every week, at least every month, certainly, we filed a lawsuit saying, no, actually, the law says that you need to release. This is public information, just like the name of that officer is public information and should be released. And I'll tell you a story about the name of the officer in a minute. So that explains that. We weren't trying in any way to besmirch or to distort the story or to slant it one way or the other. You know, we're not, that's not our business. That's not what we do. What we do is try to find the truth, as I said earlier. And so that was part of it. Now, I'll tell you the story about the officer. We're talking about how it took them a couple of days to release the name of the officer, maybe several days. Do you know what we found after they released the name of the officer? Incredibly and mysteriously, his name had disappeared from the internet. Somehow, very curiously, and any reporter that's worked on this, Brittany probably knows this, you just couldn't find anything. It's like he never existed. Mm-hmm. Now that's interesting. How'd that happen? Well, I don't know this for a fact, but I suspect that somebody went in there and swept out the information from various websites. You can employ a company to go do that, and we strongly suspect that that's what happened. So I don't think that's right. If that's what happened, and if it is what happened, and we find out about it, we're going to definitely report it. That's wrong.
Might I suspect you doing a PRA for all expenditures during the month of August for this police department or the city?
Say that again. I'm sorry.
Might I suspect a PRA, a Public Records Act request for all the financial records, for all the spending that was done by Ferguson in the month of August?
Oh, absolutely.
Well, that might take it to 2016, but that's a possibility. But no. Watching Chief Jackson on Sunday and watching him on the following days after, I do believe, well, watching the whole Ferguson leadership as a whole, I do believe that, as with any situation, from a PR perspective, with having some kind of knowledge of PR, you do want to cover yourself. So to say that Ferguson did not do a cover-up to a certain extent, for him to deny that, I mean, any kind of situation you're going to do, you're going to have to make yourself look better than that, what to cover yourself from that situation. So Ferguson definitely, without a fact, it's fact. I mean, they cannot deny that any kind of person that does a job writing PR would try to make Ferguson look better or try to recover Ferguson from the situation. So I do believe that there is definitely a cover-up that's going to be exposed.
So on the lawsuit regarding the juvenile record, have you found anything? Is there any juvenile record?
At this point, they have not released. We're not even sure that there is a juvenile record. Let's be clear. He may not have one single thing on a record. The judge has said, we're not going to release the record, but we will tell you that he did not face a major felony. And, in fact, he didn't face, and certainly as an adult and even as a juvenile, the two or three most serious felonies he is never charged with. Now, there's some lesser crimes that maybe he was charged with. They are continuing to keep that secret. No, that's where it stands.
Now, have you done the same thing for the officer? I mean, I haven't seen much about his background. If he has any other charges against him, any other allegations against him, whether at this department, the last department.
Yeah, the one thing that's on his record that they've made public is that he won an award. That's what's out there, Paul. And believe me, we have a team of investigative reporters. Among their chief task is to figure out the story on this officer, and they've been working it and working it and working it, and will continue to work it. I don't know if you saw our paper last Sunday, but the centerpiece 1A, 80-inch story last Sunday was the story of how it was that Michael Brown's body lay there for the four hours and 15 minutes, according to the official records, quote unquote. That was the product of this investigative team. The previous Sunday, we had a story, a lengthy story, again on a Sunday on the front page, and it was talking about witnesses who saw the actual shooting and how they described it. We worked on getting those witnesses for days and weeks, trying to convince them to talk to us. So these efforts are going on. We are not stopping. We are continuing.
Just saw a question that came up on Twitter. Let me ask this question before I forget it. This has to do with talking about Michael Brown being accused of strong-arm robbery in the theft of some cigarillos. Why was it labeled strong-arm robbery in the media?
Well, it may have been labeled a strong-arm robbery because it looked from the video as though he was pushing the store owner.
And that's the term that the police used. The police put it out there that it was a strong-armed robbery.
I think it means that the weapon wasn't used, right? I mean, that's the difference. When it's strong-armed versus armed,
right. Mm-hmm.
Strong-arm means that it's just with your physical presence or that there wasn't a gun or a knife.
Okay. I'm sorry, Patricia, you were going to say something before.
Yes. I wanted to say that, Chris, I was mad with you guys for going after the juvenile record of a dead guy. It came off as if you were just, it came, the act, I'm not going to say you, so it came off as if they're trying to dig up dirt. We all know that they cleaned the officer's record so that way there's nothing to find. Mike Brown and his family hadn't had that opportunity. But to go and try to get a record that's closed just because he's dead now to try to make him look like... It did not sit well, and it came off really bad. So I don't know in the future moving forward if that's something legislatively that can be, fixed. Because I think what you did as a kid, that's what you did as a juvenile. That should be closed. So the idea that now you're dead, we're going to open up all your records, if there are any, we need to take a look at that because it really comes off as if you're trying to smear the victim. And... On the strong arm robbery, using that term strong arm robbery. That might be the legal definition. A lot of us saw some aggressive shoplifting. Like, he went overboard on it. It just seems like there was really this taint to try to make what happened in that store, one, more than what it was, and two, it actually had nothing to do with why he was shot. So it really comes off as another smear job. Why that even got released, that outraged the community at a tremendous level. That was extremely irresponsible, and that is really when people called for Chief Jackson's job. That's what did that.
Well, the fact that the term strong arm robbery was used, it was used by the police first. And so I would think it would be unethical for folks in the journalism who are journalists to change up the terms that are used by the police department. That means that they're trying to persuade. If the police department only saw a report that says it was a strong arm robbery, well, your job is to report facts. And if there's a police report, potential police report that says it was a strong arm robbery that happened, that you have to report that. And it's up to the people that's watching that. I mean, you see the video. Just because you see the words are used, strong arm robbery, does not mean that you have to see it as a strong arm robbery. You have the option to have your own opinion about it. And so, but as far as people in the media, they have to do what the training says. The training says to be non-partial. So if the police are releasing that, that's what they have to report.
I'm going to borderline play devil's advocate because reporters, we've been saying this over and over, we are in search of truth. People are asking us what's happening, what's going on, what don't we know, this is not adding up. How many times have I done stories? We don't know what led up to this, but we know right now, all police can confirm. And us reporters kept going to police. What happened? What led up to this? What led up to this altercation in the car? We kept asking that. And then finally, I will never forget that interview. We were outside in the park. And then, you know, we were like, well, why are you just now telling us this? And the chief says, well, you guys asked for it. You know, you guys kept asking, so we had to release it. We were going to hold it, but y'all kept asking for it. I'm not going to say that was the right decision. I mean, it's up to him. But my job was to try to find the answers, to try to find out what happened, what led up to the death, what he was doing earlier, what police knew that we didn't know. And so, you know, was everybody happy with what they found out? No, but I mean, I'm just playing devil's advocate, guys.
I thought the way in which the police handled the release of that video was very poor. And, you know, they were just obviously trying to play defense for Officer Wilson. And they were just trying to drag, Brown, make him look bad. On the other hand, I think it's potentially relevant to what happened. It sort of depends on whether or not, and I don't think we know yet, at least I don't know, whether Officer Wilson knew about the robbery at the time that he and Brown had their altercation. I mean, I've heard it said one way, and I've heard it said the other as well. So if he did know about that, then it goes to sort of the state of mind. It goes potentially to Wilson's state of mind, and it also goes to Brown's possible state of mind. So it could actually be relevant, and even could end up in a court trial.
No, the chief said that he didn't know about the robbery before, because I remember asking him that.
My recollection is the chief said that at the time that Wilson first told Brown to get out of the street, that he didn't know about it. I saw it indicated that, however, by the time he had heard about it by the time the altercation occurred, and this was the reason that Wilson had backed up and further engaged him. I don't know this to be. I'm just saying that there are different accounts, and if the account about him knowing about it is true, then it's potentially relevant information.
Well, I think it's important for citizens to be involved in government or any kind of civil job, because the video was released and the initial story was that the officer encountered Michael Brown because of the video. But then the retraction was made, well, he didn't know about it. Well, that shows you that you cannot be too trusting of certain things. You have to take things at face value, but then do your research beyond what is told to you. You have to be your own researcher and research what really happened and be ready to dissect whatever is told to you. Don't just take things at face value. I think it's important. A lot of times people, they rely on the media to be the voice. I mean, that's true. But at the same time, you have your own voice, you have your own mind, you have your own ability to find out about things. So it's important if I tell you what happened in North St. Louis, well, if you want to know about what happened in North St. Louis, you can do your own research and find out what really happened. So
have they released the police audio, the police radio calls? Because that's what I heard, is that they released the video, and then they said, but he didn't know about the robbery when he stopped him. And then later it was, well, he did know about it. So have they released the police radio calls or the 911 calls? Or
There's no indication that the police radio was recorded. So we don't know that even exists. They certainly haven't released it. What was released was a guy was making a recording for his lady friend.
Yeah.
And in the course of making this, you know, what he intended to be romantic recording, it happened to be at the moment of the shooting. And so you heard a burst of gunfire, a pause, and then another burst of gunfire. And that is reputed to be that shooting. And I couldn't tell you for sure that that's what that is, although I did see a report that someone had authenticated it. I'm not exactly sure if that's reliable. But that is, what do you call it, probative, if you're a lawyer? That has got value to it, because what it shows is something that we didn't really know, is that there were two different bursts of gunfire. That's interesting, that there was a burst, and then there was a pause, and then there was another burst. And the bullets came fast. I mean, it was boom, boom, boom. You know, that doesn't mean that the officer's guilty. That doesn't mean that the officer's innocent. But it's interesting. It's information. I want to get back to. May I get back to Patricia, because she was expressing her anger and frustration at our decision to. And I heard some other people agreeing with that. The anger, and I just want to tell you, I hear you. I mean, I would never try to talk you out of your feeling about something that we did that you feel is wrong. That is your feeling, and that is valid. I'm not arguing, okay? But I will say this, that if we start deciding what kind of information the public shouldn't ever really see, just be careful. Just be careful. Because who decides in the end what information the public doesn't get to see? Well, guess what? It's the government. And so if you start to say, well, now, that's don't let them see that. What you're actually saying is don't let us see that. And then all of a sudden they can say, well, then we're not going to release the name of the police officer. And then all of a sudden they can say, well, you know, you can't see those emails. Yeah, they were government emails. They were messages from a police chief but you can't see it. And this is what government wants to do. This is the natural inclination of government, is to keep stuff secret because it makes them look bad, or they're afraid it'll make them look bad. And what we try to do is get the information out. And again, I'm not negating your feelings about that. I'm just trying to explain kind of where we come from on that issue.
Chris, I get you, but I also think that there's a time and a place to release information, and sometimes it's out in the public, and other times it should be done through the court of law, through those proper processes, because what winds up happening is that you dirty a potential jury pool. People are watching the news, and when they are get called to do jury duty, they cannot erase what's already been shown, whether it's relevant or not. So I think that there is a time and a place for information, and we need to go through the proper channels for some of those things, so that way we don't mess up the justice process.
Okay, I agree, but let's take your example. All right, let's say Officer Wilson had four complaints in the last 6 months, and I'm making this up. This is not true. I'm making this up. Okay,
don't tweet.
We're into fantasy land now. All right, don't put this on Twitter. Okay, Ave said the officer, but let's just pretend that Officer Wilson had faced four different complaints of using excessive force in the last 6 months, and let's just say that the police department decided, you know what? That information could poison that grand jury that's hearing that case. We better keep that secret, because after all, we want to be fair. Oh, my gosh. I mean, that would be a complete injustice to keep that secret, because that might be relevant. You see what I'm saying?
We're talking apples and oranges.
No,
I think a juvenile record that is closed while somebody is living, I do not think should be open just because they're dead and then shown to the public.
Fair enough. That's a fair point.
Okay. Yeah, I'm sympathetic.
Another question coming. Good. I got a whole ton of questions up here. There's a lack of trust between the public and the police, but also between the public and the media. How does this coverage change that relationship, or does it? How does will anything change this dynamic between the public and the media?
You mean this discussion here?
Our discussion today?
Our discussion today. Obviously, the coverage hasn't changed the public's mind very much, since they think that media has been, you know, according to this Remington poll, that they think that the media has hurt more than helped. So we got a long way to go to make people, I think that we're doing a good job.
Well, as I said before, I'll say it again, you have the power to control what you see. I mean, so if you're not liking what's going on, you can do something about it.
I saw a question on Twitter that I wanted to ask, and it had to do, let me refer it to come back up, because I don't want to get it wrong, but it had to do with the emotions. You know, where does your integrity come into play? I got to find a question that I can ask. A panelist mentioned the role of social media in making Ferguson a national story. A Twitter hashtag or Ferguson showed a spike when the Washington Post and HuffPo reporters were arrested. At what point in the narrative of Mike Brown's death and the following arrest did the story truly become national? Did the treatment of reporters spark national coverage? If not, what moved the story to the issue of national media focus? I think we already covered that.
Yeah.
The fact that they let Mike Brown lie there for 4.5 hours. He was unarmed. He was shot 6 times.
Police response.
How do we keep the coverage going about something that is so important? Now, I understand the coverage is still continuing here in Ferguson. I haven't seen much more national coverage on it, though.
I still get press calls. I want people to know that the world, and when I say the world, seriously, the world is still interested in how we're doing. While everyone has left, I still get calls maybe probably about every other day, whether it's from national reporters or even from international reporters wanting to know what's going on. So I guess it's not blared across the TV screen and on Twitter all the time now. But people are checking in, because I don't want people to get the sense that, oh, the media wants to get their clicks, their pictures, and they've taken off. I have relationships with some reporters now, and they really do. Okay, what's the next steps? What are you guys doing? How'd the council meeting go? What's the next protest plan? So the interest is very much still here. Of course, it doesn't feel like much after what we've been through, but people actually want to see St. Louis and this region start moving forward from this.
Yes, yeah, absolutely.
Go ahead.
My whole role with Huffington Post is to continue coverage on Ferguson, because, as you know, Ferguson is the case study of America. National media has dwindled off. The big news people are gone, but there still needs to be coverage on it. I'm going to vow to continue it. I know locals are still going to be here, and we're going to see what happens. We need to know how Ferguson changes after the verdict, after everything, so that every city in America that's going through this can know what to do when it happens or how to heal.
Yeah, I don't think that this is a story that's going to die down anytime soon. But just to give you a look into my life as a reporter, you know, I'm a general assignment reporter. And so every morning, we're taking a look at what's happening in the city. And if the bigger story is today I was doing a double shooting outside of a church in Riverview, you know, for that community, that was the big story of the day. Now, that does not mean that I'm losing sight of what's going on in Ferguson. I'm keeping very close tabs of what's happening. My followers are keeping me updated. I'm still following everything. And if tomorrow I need to be in Ferguson, then I'll be in Ferguson. But if the, you know, the other bigger story in the St. Louis region is something else, I get it, and I'm willing to do that.
I don't think this, I agree that I don't think this media, this story is going to die down. I mean, just last week, there were all sorts of segments on National Public Radio about, you know, the actions to try to change the way fines are meted out in Ferguson. There were several stories in the Washington Post about the handling of the grand jury in St. Louis County. So I think the national folks are keeping their eye on it. And just think of all the stories that are out there still to do. I mean, there's going to be all the developments in the criminal case, you know, whether or not there's an indictment, if there's an indictment, whether there's a trial, if there's an acquittal or no indictment, there's a federal investigation. Meanwhile, Holder has announced, you know, the Attorney General has announced this pattern and practice investigation is going to go on for months about police practices. This story, and that doesn't even, that's just on the police end of things. You know, what about the whole big issue of race? And I mean, don't we want to look at the schools in that area? I mean, it's not just a coincidence that Normandy School District was an unaccredited school district from which Michael Brown graduated. I mean, are we doing everything we need to be doing in those schools to educate our students? There are just a million related stories. I don't think the story's going to die.
I just realized this, but in my story today, even though I was in Riverview and I'm talking about this double shooting, all the people that I interviewed were people that had come from Ferguson and moved to get away from the protests. And now they're living in Riverview, and then there's this double shooting. Until the beginning of my package, I'm talking about Ferguson, even though I'm in Riverview. And I remember listening in my ear, I may not have been in Ferguson, but there were reads like back to back, and Ferguson was still coming up through the newscast. So it's not going to die down anytime soon.
This is a question for Christopher. How do traditional media educate the public about where to go to get fair and unbiased nonpartisan news coverage? How do you combat the false reports found online and on social media? What is the Post-Dispatch doing to reach young audiences who tend to consume and share their news and the news they find on social media?
Wow, that is a great question and a very complex one. We could talk a lot about it. I would say that we've seen in our society in the last 5 years especially, traditional journalism challenged. I mean, mainly for economic reasons. The business model of journalism, I'm sorry to use the coarse language, but it's in the crapper. I mean, we're not making, people don't want to pay for news. They think news should just be free. And there's also an increasing, especially among young people, as you say, there's an increasing tendency to say, you know what, if it's big news, it's just going to find me. My friends will link to it, you know. It'll come to me, right? Okay, so how do we react to that? Well, one, I would say the most important thing we can do is reaffirm our principles of ethical traditional journalism. Reaffirm the search for truth. Because if all that's left are those blowhards on Fox News who just want to give their opinion, and then the only other people are the blowhards in MSNBC that want to give their opposing opinion, then where are the facts? How do you find out what's actually real? There has got to be for our society a place to go for actual information, a radio station, a television station, a news website, etc. So organizations like STL Public Radio, like KMOV, like the Post-Dispatch, etc., you know, exist to provide that unbiased and real information. What are we doing? One of the things we're doing is we're trying to get much better on Twitter and Facebook. Because, as I said a minute ago, that's where people want to find their news. That's where they expect to find it. They don't want to go searching for it. It needs to be there for them when they want it instantly. And that's one of the many things that we're trying to do. We report fast. We get stuff up on our website. But more importantly, we push it out there. We push it out there on Facebook and Twitter. And so I would say, you know, visit at STL Today on any of those outlets, please, and you know, learn what we're doing. You don't have to agree with it. You can be angry about it. I totally get it. In fact, I'm thrilled that you're angry about something that we did. That's actually good because you care, because you're in it. You're living this life. I would say that's what we got to do.
Okay. This is for Bradley. The entire point of you as, I think the entire point you made is the media is supposed to fact check and not leave it up to the public to fact check later. This mindset is exactly why citizens are blaming the media. I don't quite get that.
Well, whoever said that, do you mean the fact that is the way I heard this, you saying that it's not up to you to fact check the media? Well, if I'm wrong, if you said that, if you want to stand up, you can. But if not,
I think it's the entire point of you is as media, the media is to fact check and not leave it up to the viewers to fact check.
Well, I disagree with that. I mean, if you say that, that means you're going to be a person that's easily controlled because. It's not up to the media to always fact check. I mean, if I tell you something, I tell you the bathroom's on fire. I mean, I'm part of the media. Are you going to believe that? I mean, are you going to really believe the bathroom's on fire, or are you going to go and try to find out if the bathroom's on fire? So, it's up to you to not only hear things, but also get it from a different perspective and find out if it's true or not.
And then you it's a relationship. You know, you grow a relationship with possibly a reporter or with the news station. You know, it's a trusted relationship. Like, I know I can call KMOV or I know I can watch KMOV and they're going to give me the facts. And if you really feel passionately about that, then you're fine. But, you know, if you have, you know, you see something randomly on Twitter and you don't know who this person is, you don't know who tweeted this, you don't know if this picture is accurate, maybe you do need to do a little digging.
I just wanted to give one example on that. It reminded me of the fourth night of tear gas that initially was said, this is not tear gas. I think it was people like me and other people who were out there saying, no, we know what tear gas is. We've experienced this. This is the fourth night. These aren't just smoke bombs. This is tear gas. And once all of us, this is tear gas. This is a lie. This is not right. We're out here. This is tear gas. All of a sudden, the story changed. So there is a time for, I guess, citizen journalism and people using social media to say, no, guys, you did not get that right. And that's how that works.
Anyway, I was out there tonight, and so you have the police telling us that, hey, it's not tear gas. It's smoke bombs. And so, I mean, you're going to report what you think is true. But that's why it's also important for you guys to fact check. Well, if we're saying it's, if the police are saying it's tear gas and if the media is saying it's tear gas, but you're actually out there and say, hey, it's actually tear gas, so it's up to you to, hey, call the station or say, you know what, this is actually what it is. It's actually what's really going on.
You only have to smell that sweet smell of tear gas once.
What?
To know tear gas.
Yep.
Okay. How have media outlets who allow readers to comment on stories help lead the story? STL Today has a history of racist-driven comments on any story involving African-American victims. Do these comments encourage negative editorials as a follow-up?
Well, I completely agree with the premise of that story, that some of our commentators clearly have opinions that they just need to keep to themselves, and I wish that they would. Now, having said that, we allow comments on stories, and that includes some comments that, frankly, piss me off. But I don't get to pick and choose just the comments I like. In fact, I don't have the time to do that. I mean, have you seen, you know, some stories have 1,000 comments on them. We don't have the personnel literally to go through. However, abusive behavior and profanity and such, we try to flag and get rid of those. But it's a tough question, these comments. Do they affect our editorial decisions about what we cover and how we cover them? Absolutely not.
This is the one thing I would totally disagree with you on, Christopher. I think the newspaper has the responsibility to take the racist comments off, and has every ability to do that. And if they don't have enough people to do it, then hire some more people or don't run any comments.
Yeah, I think I would agree with that. If someone is being blatantly racist, I'd love to just lift that off. And we do. I mean, we have people even here tonight. There's one right there who has killed how many? 10,000 nasty, awful comments? Countless. Absolutely. We don't want to see that crap on our website. Believe me. We think it's hideous. At the same time, though, you know, there's going to be some comments that I disagree with, but that's no reason to just kill them off because I disagree. But, yeah, when you get to profanity, when you get to racism, when you get to antisocial behavior like the some of these comments. I agree.
You know, I'm not sure when. I guess after Donald Sterling had his rant, and I was interviewed by, I forget who it was, and they asked me whether I think this is a problem, and it absolutely is a problem. There was once a time when it was not politically correct to throw the N-word out there, to berate people for their race or their gender or their sexual preference. Social media has changed that because people now can hide behind a false name, a false account, a username they create, or an avatar, and I think people's true feelings